This is On and Off Your Mat Podcast, episode 218, Living in Accord with the Yamas and Niyamas. If you love reflecting on your life, you enjoy yoga philosophy, or you want to apply the principles of yoga to your practice on the mat and your life off the mat, today's episode is going to be right up your alley. For today's episode, I sat down with David McGrath. David is a Kriya Yoga therapist and author of the book, The Yogi's Way, Living in Accord with the Yamas and Niyamas, hence our subject of today. He's dedicated to sharing the philosophical and psychological principles and practices of yoga with a focus on promoting the holistic capacity of yoga to provide insight into what it means to be human and how we can appreciate and live in tune with the nature of life. David was ordained by Mr. Roy Eugene Davis, a direct disciple of Paramahansa Yogananda, as a minister within the tradition of Kriya Yoga in 2011. He is trained and experienced as an educator and coach and is currently completing his formation as a psychoanalytical psychotherapist with the Lacanian School of Psychoanalysis. We sat down today to talk about his book, The Yogi's Way, and the framework for living the yamas and niyamas offer us on and off your mat. If you're completely new to the yamas and niyamas, you might want to start with our episode number 25 all the way back then, called The Eight Limbs with Janet Stone. That episode will give you an intro and a context for that set of principles we'll be talking about today. And that was our most popular episode of all time, so it's definitely worth adding to your cue list. If today's episode inspires you in any way, share it and help someone else on their journey towards living a life that is more aligned and connected. As always, I love to read your takeaways on the episode. So take a screenshot of you listening, share something you've learned, something that inspires you, and make sure to tag at On and Off Your Mat Podcast or erica.belanger on Instagram, and I can see them and I'll be able to reshare them. Before we get to today's episode, I have one more reminder to tell you about Recharge, Reconnect, and Reset, the retreat. CART is closing on March 31st, so you have a couple weeks left to join us in this life-changing in-person immersion that is like getting 3 months of coaching with me packed in 7 days. For my last-minute people, I added a free gift. So if you join in the next couple of weeks, you will also receive a free massage at the hotel spa during your stay to supercharge your relaxation. It's time to claim your spot and your massage before they're all gone. Go to ericabelanger.com/retreat for all the juicy details you need, or go ahead and send me a DM or an email and we'll chat. You'll have all of those in the show notes. All right, if you're ready to jump into today's episode with David, let's go. It's going to be a good one. Hi, David.
Hi, Erica.
Thank you so much for joining me today.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So, David, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your journey for our listeners that don't know you yet?
Very good. Let me see if I can summarize this without taking up the whole program, because journeys are usually quite long. And I can't say it's over. I'm based here in Ireland. And I offer services as both a teacher and as a therapist. I've arrived at this point basically because I've been involved in my own journey of self-discovery. And I feel at this point, I might have something to offer in some way of supporting people.
Yeah, of course. You are the author of the book, The Yogi's Way. Why did you decide to write this particular book? And tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, that question, again, that's going to open up another box. I was in the process of writing a commentary on the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali, which I'm still in the process of writing.
Big endeavor.
Yeah, yeah, it is. And it's also, as you writing it, and for your listeners who are familiar with the text, there's layers and layers of meaning which can be extracted from it. Yes. And some of it can be very conceptual, as in it can go down avenues of huge abstraction. And I just thought that the yamas and niyamas is something that I was quite familiar with through my practice over the decades, but it was something that I began to see I had not really given due consideration. When saying that, you know, I did reflect a lot on the different yamas and niyamas. Actually, I was quite disciplined in using them as a kind of a template for reflection, but somehow I kind of prioritized the other aspects of the eight limbs offered within Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, and in a way where the formal practices, the breathing practices, well, the asanas, the breathing practices, the concentration techniques and formal meditation practice, that kind of seemed to be of greater significance in my mind over the yamas and niyamas. But due to life experience and I suppose natural maturation, I started to understand that the yamas and niyamas play a vital role, one which is, I think, beyond measure, really, equally as important. And this obviously will make sense. It's equally as important as all the other limbs within the eight limb system. But really, really, not just in words, it is equally as important as the other limbs. Yeah.
I mean, some people say that they're more important than the other limbs. What's your thought on that?
I think I was being a little bit diplomatic, bit moderate in my expression. It's hard to kind of measure it out more or less. I think that the eight limb system is a kind of a unified system, all with the same goal, same objective, yoga. But the yamas and niyamas, I feel, are hugely significant because they provide a framework for living, for being able to take what we do in our formal practice, as we've just mentioned, the asana and the breathing and the concentration techniques and meditation, take what we experience within that kind of incubated space, that place where we're able to cut ourselves off from the world and just, well, internalize our attention and experience the benefit of that. The yamas and niyamas provide us a kind of a framework for how then we're supposed to transfer that experience into our day-to-day living. So in that way, I think, yeah, not to be underestimated.
So I want to come back to a few things that you've said, but before we kind of dive into the different parts, for people that haven't listened to our episode on the eight limbs, which was episode 25, guys. So we're talking 5 years ago. So maybe you haven't seen that episode. You can go back and listen with Janet Stone. But for now, can you give us a little overview on what are the eight limbs? Just so we kind of all have the same vocabulary and baseline to start. And I'm excited that we're talking about this because that episode number 25 on the eight limbs was our most popular of all 200 something episodes, guys. So after we're done here, if you want to go deeper and talk about all the limbs, you can go and do that episode next, add it to your queue. So for now, David, can you give us a little overview of what are the eight limbs? Like, what is the yogi's path?
Okay. Well, the eight limbs are outlined in the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali, and the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali is made up of four books, and they're outlined in book two and in book three. And the first two limbs are what I've written the book on, the Yogi's Way. It's written on the yamas and niyamas. They're the first two limbs. And as we've mentioned, they kind of refer to a framework for living. Then after that, you have asana as the third limb, which is what a lot of people are engaged in, body postures as a way of removing restlessness from the body and to experience some kind of clarity in terms of mind-body awareness. And then following that, you have pranayama, which, each of these topics you could go into a great amount of detail, but pranayama, it's referred to as the regulation of prana. And prana, well, there's five different types of prana, but the one that's focused on is breathing, the regulation of the currents within the body through breath work. So you've got breathing exercises to help facilitate that. And then as a consequence of regulating the physiology, regulating what's going on in the body, removing restlessness through asana and through pranayama breathing techniques, you're able then to facilitate a process of internalization, moving your attention inwards. So this is referred to as pratyahara. So this is the fifth limb. And it's often referred to as being the bridge from what we do in relation to our gross manifested experience to a more subtle experience. So we're moving inwards with pratyahara. And then following pratyahara, we can engage in concentration techniques. So this is dharana, where we will use some object of focus. And the object of focus could be the breath or mantra or focusing our attention on one specific thing or there's a whole variety of different techniques which could be used, but the idea is to cultivate one-pointed concentration. So that's called dharana. And then when this concentration moves into a steady flowing state, it transitions into what's referred to as meditation. So meditation in the Sanskrit term is dhyana. So the last three limbs, concentration, meditation, and the final one, which is absorption, they're often referred to as samyama. They're hard to pull apart as being separate. They're kind of three sides to the one thing. And basically, that comes down to the fact that we establish concentration. The concentration begins to flow, but it might become interrupted. And then we try to reestablish the flow, and then it might become interrupted. But when the flow is sustained for a period, it's meditation. And now, the meditation, if you're using an object, after a certain period of time, when the meditation's flowing, your attention can become so absorbed in that object that now you're experiencing what you could refer to as a samadhi state with the support of an object. But there's another type of concentration which can be cultivated, which is concentration without the support of an object, where there's nothing that's used to anchor one's attention to or to identify with. And so when you move through to the state of meditation where your concentration is flowing to this objectless concentrated state, then it will eventually arrive at where your attention is absorbed in that objectless state. And that's a basic outline of what the eight limbs of yoga are. Yoga itself as a term, the reference usually used is to the old English word yoke, but we can talk about oneness or oneness consciousness. But within Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, the term samadhi and yoga are synonymous. So that final limb, samadhi, is yoga.
It's the state of yoga.
It's the state of yoga, or the realization of yoga, the moving into the experience of what is truly to be experienced. But that samadhi is broken down within Patanjali's Yoga Sutra. It's described in variant degrees or to differing degrees, which there is a framework to help the practitioner to understand that samadhi can be experienced, but as we've mentioned, it can be with an object, without an object, and the experience can be referenced in that way. Yoga, as the samadhi of awareness, the awareness of just existing, of beingness without any identification or relying on any particular thing to justify or to resubstantiate your sense of self. It's just the experience of beingness is arrived at as a consequence of this process, of facilitating this process.
It's the result.
It's the result. Yeah. So The Yogi's Way, the book that you've mentioned, the book I've written, it's focusing primarily on the yamas and niyamas. Now, interestingly, the yamas and niyamas, the last three niyamas are focused on three specific practices, which are self-discipline, self-study, and surrender. Surrender to the wholeness of life, if you want to say, or surrender to the oneness of life or the oneness of creation. So those last three aspects of niyama,
they prepare you.
They do, but they also actually reiterate what the practice is. Because when we talk about asana and breath work, they're fundamentally a means to remove restlessness so that somebody can actually sit still.
Yeah, the goal is not the pose. The goal is not the breath practice itself. The goal is what you create in the state after.
Yeah, and it just facilitates a process. You know, in the Yoga Sutra, the second limb, it outlines exactly what yoga is, and it's translated in different ways, but it's the neutralizing or the removing or the overcoming of what could be referred to as movements, things which are taking place within the field of conscious expression. But there's so much stuff taking place. And even as your listeners are listening to this podcast, they're probably doing something else. Maybe they just missed the last sentence. And so they have to go back and they have to re-listen, or they have to make the decision. Do they just keep on going? Do they forget about it? So there's a lot of different things going on. There's a lot of different movements taking place in what we experience as me or you. There's a lot going on at a physical level, an emotional level, at a mental level. And so the whole process offered within the eight limbs is to basically to learn to discipline our relationship to each aspect of our being, physical, emotional, and mental. And so the yamas and niyamas, they include that practice of discipline, but they also, specifically the yamas, they help us to bring it back into our day-to-day life. What is it that we're doing? How are we engaging with people and things and our different activities? And how's that relating to how we're disciplining our relationship with our physical, emotional, and mental?
And why do you think that that kind of reflection, as like they are a template for reflection and they're a framework for living, why is it an important lens to kind of look at ourselves and our life through?
It's a good question because, you know, when we hear of moral codes or an ethical framework, which, you know, the yamas and niyamas could be considered an ethical framework or a set of principles which are aiming to guide how we live, we can start to get suspicious because it's kind of like, well, who's dishing this out? Who do we have to listen to? Why do we have to take on what some other authority from some other era has passed down? What sense is there to it? And I think that's where reflection is important, because the yamas and niyamas in and of themselves aren't really anything without the person who's doing the reflecting. So as a set of like rules, they're not going to work. You know, the first principle is ahimsa, non-violence or harmlessness, and the second is satya. If you take those two, you know, we could have a whole conversation about what harmlessness is. We could talk for a full podcast episode on what harmlessness is or what truthfulness is. So when somebody comes along, you know, when they read these different principles and say, oh yeah, truthfulness, I can do that, you know.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, but that's the thing, you know, when we think of it as a framework for reflection, it's scrutinizing how we actually relate to it.
And the nuance of what it means to be truthful or to be nonviolent. It's just like, I didn't say like a clear lie, or there could be a lot more nuance to it. And I think this is where the reflection is interesting too.
Yeah, you've hit the nail on the head. It's the nuance beyond language, you know, because the word truthfulness, which is translated from satya, and not all of us are fluent in Sanskrit. So we translate it into English and we've got the word truthfulness. And then that word, it denotes a certain meaning. But depending on our life experiences and our cultural upbringing and many different factors, the nuances you refer to it, we can't expect that it's just one standard understanding. But what's of most importance is that we begin to understand what it means to us individually, in the quiet of our own minds, when we're going to bed at night and we have a sense of some kind of restlessness, which is moving around within us, the vritti moving around within us. It's disturbing our peace. It's disturbing our capacity just to be aware, because we have the residue of how we've engaged in life, which hasn't been in accord with what we would like to be.
Yeah, there's a friction inside of us because of that lack of alignment.
Yeah. And alignment, that word triggers off some kind of notions, you know, it almost kind of precludes another, you know, you're aligning to something. And I think this is where the yamas and niyamas get interesting, because the more you reflect on them, you know, you perceive them as individual concepts and that they're all quite different. And you start to see a little bit of overlap in them the more you reflect on them. But fundamentally, the difference between them as concepts starts to become eradicated and reveal itself just to be one concept. And that concept can be referred to as yoga, as oneness. Because if we start talking about ahimsa, nonviolence, and then satya, truthfulness, and if we really reflect on that in our day-to-day lives, we'll start to see that, well, the way I'm seeing myself engaging in life in relation to being harmless, and then when I go on to reflecting on how I engage in my life in terms of being truthful, I'm starting to see how these two principles really fundamentally merge. The distinction is only in the word. And then conceptually, we can talk about it and distinguish them. But in the practice, they're fundamentally integrated. And then, you know, you move on to non-stealing, asteya, and brahmacharya, and parigraha, and you do the same with all of them. It starts to dissolve the distinction between them as words, but also conceptually, so that you start to experience that this is living yoga. This is living oneness, because all of that, there are frameworks which are offered just to facilitate that process. My teacher, Roy Eugene Davis, he used to mention when he was talking about the yamas and niyamas, he said, these are just things that yogis do automatically. You know, I say yogis, but these are just things that someone who is awakened do naturally. You know, you don't have to tell them to be truthful or to not harm or to not steal. You don't have to do this. It's an automatic, innate way to express within the world. So by taking on the framework, we are kind of providing ourselves with a means to live in accord with how somebody who is awakened might live. But in the process of the reflection, which the book offers, because really it's a guided journal, which is aimed at personal reflection, it supports that peeling back the layers which separate you from the experience of living in accord with the principle, because your mind does such a good job at rationalizing the concept of it. So you're really forced to go beyond your conceptual understanding and more embody it.
Mm-hmm. So that alignment, if we think of yoga and we think of oneness, is between us and us. You know, it's kind of an inward circular kind of alignment, and not so much us and the principles that are outside of us.
Yeah. And the word us, again, your words are triggering me off with this. You know, when we use these pronouns, whether it's a subject pronoun like I and you, and then we've got the possessive pronoun or the personal pronoun, all of these pronouns that we're using, it kind of brings to the forefront the idea that we're doing something. I'm using this book and I'm reflecting on the yamas and niyamas. That's okay. But then that question of I'm doing it and I'm doing it for me, you know, to align with my own inner sense. But fundamentally, in the same way as the words kind of dissolve into the concept and that dissolves into the experience of the way you actually live, the same thing happens in terms of how you relate to yourself. Yeah, I'm doing this for me, but that dissolves into doing it for, you know, the people around me, into the society or the community that I'm living in. And it dissolves down into the oneness of life. I'm doing it for life itself, because all there is the expression of life. So it's just this continuous moving away of what separates us.
That's a good reminder. If we're using the books and we're using the yamas, niyamas as a framework for living, and we're trying to transfer that onto the mat into our lives, how do we do that? Where do we start? What are the steps we can consider? Or how do we start to live the yamas and niyamas?
Well, I suppose, first of all, to become familiar with them, to actually identify, there's 10 of them. There's five yamas and five niyamas. And, you know, I've referred to the yamas a lot. The yamas sometimes can be isolated as being related to our external life and the niyamas related to our inner life. I don't do this distinguishing just because I feel that they're all pertinent to our overall expression. So when you talk about how do you move it away from your formal practice, what do you do in the seclusion of your house? Your home or wherever you're living, how do you transfer what you experience there into day-to-day life with the yamas and niyamas? Becoming familiar with them as concepts is the first step, I think. Again, I'll just go back to ahimsa. You know, the word is very fancy and it looks nice when it's written down. Translated into English, maybe it just looks a bit more familiar and a little less serious. Harmlessness, you know, especially in the year that we're living, there's a lot of awareness around this concept of harmlessness. And then we can get kind of very black and white about it and talk, well, does it mean vegetarianism? Does it mean that, you know, I just don't hit people or, you know, I refrain from killing people? And then maybe people will go, well, maybe it means that I'm not supposed to, you know, put down mouse traps and these kind of things. But that kind of stuff is very, I think, gross. It's very distracting from really what's at the core of ahimsa, harmlessness. To really understand harmlessness, we really have to pull it apart because all of the things that I just mentioned there, vegetarianism, not putting down mousetraps, not hitting people, like that's not fundamentally going to change how we relate to the world. You know, you could be a very good vegetarian, but still be an asshole. You know, you could still be behaving in ways which is causing people a lot of harm. You go for dinner in someone's house and you make a big fuss about the food that they've made because they didn't happen to tend to your needs as a vegetarian. So you can get very caught up in causing, in the idea of that, how harmless you are when what you're focusing on is actually very mundane, very everyday. So the idea is that we just get very more approach the cause, and the cause is really within us. It can only be approached really by starting to examine how we're relating to the concept, not just the word, but the concept, like how that concept manifests itself in how we engage in life on a day-to-day level.
Yeah, so that might include like judgment or the way you talk to yourself or about others, like even if it's just to you or your partner, like there's very little more subtle things that you might not think are harmful. But if you look at yourself in the mirror and all you say every day is how terrible of a person you are, or you look, or that is a way that you're harming yourself as well. You might not even think about that.
Yeah, this brings up an important part because, you know, when we look at self-help guidance or support and we go about receiving instruction from people or guidance in retreats and workshops and different things, there can be a tendency to acquire information and then have this information as a kind of a kit, a toolkit that we now need to apply ourselves to. And it brings about a kind of a responsibility, a new responsibility, an added demand on top of all the other demands that we have going on in our life. And so we go home and then a week passes and we haven't even opened the kit or we haven't applied it and we haven't really engaged in it in any significant way. And then we meet somebody else who was at the workshop or somebody else who read the book and they mention it. And then the guilt sets in about how we haven't done it. And we start to kind of punish ourselves, not necessarily in anything physical, but in our thinking. Now, I'm not talking about this specifically in relation to harmlessness. I'm talking about it in terms of how we approach the yamas and niyamas. We don't want to see it as being a demand that's made of us. We don't want to see it as being a toolkit that now we have some obligation to engage in if we're going to experience life in a better way. I think it's better to look at the yamas and niyamas as, you used the words lens earlier, as being something which is there as a friend, really, a support system to help you to just remove the stuff which is causing you upset or suffering. And so when we talk about it in that way, the way I've laid out the book is that it's systematically, you know, at the beginning, it'll talk about, it's broken down for your listeners without shocking them too much. It's broken down over 2.5 years. So the yamas and niyamas, as I said, there's five of each, so that's 10. So one sequence takes 10 weeks, and then the second sequence takes another 10 weeks. And I believe there are 17 or 18 sequences in the book. So it takes a good period of time. But the idea is that you're returning to the same principle over and over, like visiting a friend. So you've done ahimsa in the first sequence on the first week. Come back in the second sequence and you're doing it again in the 11th week and you're doing it in the 21st week and the 31st week. And every time you come back, it's a kind of a refamiliarizing yourself with that principle, but not as you feeling a demand on being made of yourself, but more as an opportunity for you to understand how you relate to the principle as you relate to the friend. So if you think about a friendship, you know, if you're friends with somebody, you take time to get to know them. You take time to kind of see what's going on for them. And in that way, it's reflected back to you, your relationship, the kind of interdependency, the inter support, the respect that you have for each other, the bond. And that's what each of the yamas and niyamas is. It's an opportunity to understand the bond that you have with life itself, but that it's going to be offered to you by your commitment to actually making time to reflect on them. So, you know, when you say making time, it sounds like a demand. But when you talk about your friends, it doesn't feel like a demand with your friends.
Just making a choice.
Yeah, you're hanging out and you're doing it because your friend helps you through that relationship. Your friend gives you an opportunity for you to experience yourself. If you didn't have any personal relationships, you'd be alone. And then there's that sense of not really having an existence and socialized interpersonal existence. And so with the yamas and niyamas, by giving yourself the chance to reflect on them, then you're able to understand your relationship to yourself as somebody who's engaging in life. So if somebody picks up the book, I've designed it in a certain way, and I've mentioned that it goes over a 2.5 year period or 2 years and a bit, but it's very forgiving.
It's a very easy read, yeah.
Easy read, but also if you do 1 week or you do 2 weeks and then you drop out for a while and you come back 2 months later, it's grand. It's fine. The idea is more just to know that it's a friend that's there. The book, I'm saying, is a friend that's there, but really that the yamas and niyamas are a friend that are there to support you to understand yourself in how you experience life.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a good reminder for people, because that sense of demand sometimes pushes us away. Like we were talking a bit earlier, like, I don't want to be told what to do, or whatever way you might frame that in your head. If you see it as something that is there for you and not something extra on your to-do list that is, chances are, already too long and overwhelming, it's a different way to kind of approaching. And it feels more gentle as well with yourself in that sense.
Yeah. And you know, when you ask me how you take it off the mat, how you take it away from formal practice, meditation, and how you transfer it into your life using these principles, if your listeners, maybe they don't care to buy the book, they don't even care to look at it, I would suggest that they get an idea of what the 10 principles are, what each of the five yamas and each of the five niyamas are, and to just maybe write them down, have them somewhere on the fridge, somewhere, just so that when they're in the kitchen and they're cooking, and then they see the principle, they can just have a reflection on, well, you know, how is that going for me? But if they happen to be looking at a parigraha, non-attachment, And then they're trying to reflect on that. That concept of non-attachment, you can go down many different rabbit holes in how you explore that. I've heard people say, does that mean I can't be married? You know, what happens if I'm in love? Am I not supposed to be attached to my partner? You know, all these different things, which, again, another podcast episode. But in the kitchen there, when you're, you know, frying your garlic in its oil, and you've just come across the word on the fridge, non-attachment, and it's in your head, and you think about, how is that expressing in my life? How is attachment expressing in my life and causing suffering?
That's the key. That's the important piece. Yeah, I was waiting, but you said it. So the key is not like about judging yourself into like, am I doing well enough in that sense? Am I following these quote unquote rules? It's like, how is it creating suffering in my life? How am I creating suffering in my life? And how can I step away from that by remembering and reflecting on these principles?
Yeah. When you say suffering, I think yoga is just, it's the opposite of suffering. The path of yoga and the realization of yoga is freeing or liberation from suffering. So yeah, the yamas and niyamas, that's the question that's in your head. Even when you're talking about ahimsa, what am I doing that's causing harm, which is causing suffering? Ahimsa and truthfulness and nonviolence, they're kind of more self-explanatory. But if you think of non-attachment and you think of how is it causing you suffering, then it's the suffering part that helps to make the reflection more tangible. Even when we think of losing something and, you know, it's something of significance, it might have sentimental value, and it takes us a while to get over. There's a bit of a grieving process. But that loss, it's very natural to grieve it. It's very natural to be upset about losing something dear that somebody gave to you. But we can appreciate that it's because there's a certain identification with the object. There's a certain attachment to it that's bringing about this grief. And it's not because you're trying to remove the grief or speed it up or do anything like that. It's just to recognize what's going on. And fundamentally, that's what yoga is about. It's about seeing reality as it is so that we can have the agency to position ourselves so as not to experience so much suffering.
Yeah. So you talked about how the first step is to become familiar with them and even just writing them out and having them in your kind of view every day. We've talked about a few of them, but there's a few we haven't mentioned. Can we just go over quickly what they're called, like the translation, and maybe a few words of like what it means?
Yeah, so I've gone through the yamas, which are referred to as the restraints. So these are the things that we're trying to avoid doing. So you've got ahimsa, which is nonviolence, satya, which is truthfulness, asteya, which is non-stealing. And then the fourth one is brahmacharya. And this is translated in many different ways.
This one's more difficult, yeah.
Yeah, I've translated it in the book to be walking with absolute reality. It's just that Brahma is the term for Hindu god. And so given that yoga comes from a culture which was formed the basis of Hinduism, some of the terms are relating to gods. But the essence of it is Brahma as the absolute reality. The charya is walking with that, accompanying that absolute reality.
I like that. The other translation I've heard and I've really liked was conserving your energy, and like a base principle of, I feel like relates so well to yoga and how it's a tool that is part of like energy conservation, building, nurturance, you know, all these things. So I think it makes it easier for people to see the way you're talking about it or relating to their own energy, especially when you think of oneness and, you know, oneness consciousness and all these things, rather than some other translations that are more like moderation based and these things, restrictions based.
But just when you say moderation based, again, my teacher, Roy Eugene Davis, he used to explain brahmacharya in relation to the right use of your resources.
Yeah, the same idea of energy conservation for me.
Yeah, but it also includes money. It also includes material possessions. It includes time, includes all the things that allow us to express efficiently and effectively in life. Are we using them in a way which is serving ourselves and serving others?
And allowing us to walk with absolute reality or not.
Exactly. And then the fifth one is aparigraha, which is non-attachment, which we've just been discussing. So they're the five yamas. And then the five niyamas are considered to be observances. So the things that we're trying to do, that we're trying to incorporate into our lives. So the first is saucha, which is purity. As I mentioned at the beginning, sometimes people refer to these observances or niyamas as being something more related to our own internal practice. But I think, as I mentioned, it's useful for us to see it in how we relate to life as well. So the first is saucha, purity. Second is santosha, contentment. And then the last three, which are referred to as Kriya Yoga in Patanjali's Yoga Sutra. He refers to them in the second chapter as Kriya Yoga. You have tapas, which is self-discipline, svadhyaya, which is self-study. And in the last one, using the name of the Indian god, Ishvara, it's Ishvara Pranidhana, which is, again, I translated Ishvara to absolute reality. So it's surrender to absolute reality. Ishvara denotes the aspect of, I suppose, the divine force which is responsible for creation and which exists within creation. So it's surrendering ourselves to that force within creation. I think just for the sake of the complexity of the concept, I've just called it absolute reality. Some people might call it God. Other people might call it oversoul or the, you know, higher consciousness. There's many different ways this could be termed. But the idea in the first one of the yamas where you're walking with it, I think there's something, you know, I picture a child hand in hand with their parent. There's something to do with trust, a kind of a faith in knowing that you're being guided in your process of engaging in life. And then for the Ishvara Pranidhana, the surrender, it again comes back to this trust, the fact that what's occurring, the events of life, the situations, life looks after life. It actually does a fantastic job at it. You know, when we look around and we see how it just regulates itself so well. It's so well disciplined. And us, we consider ourselves as the I, the me, you know, the David and the Erica. It all seems so important, but fundamentally, we're just expressions of life. And from that point of view, life looks after itself. So it's going to look after us. It might not be in accord with our preferences in terms of our thinking processes,
our expectations.
Yeah. Which all comes down to our conceptualized version of life, which is all down to language, and it's all down to how we use language in our thinking processes. It's got nothing to do with the actual events that are taking place. It's just more a fictitious narration, which is trying to commentate on what is actually going on.
And make sense of it with our understanding of what is reality, because I think a lot of it is beyond what we're able to put into words. Like the words are kind of limiting within language of what it actually means and is in the absolute reality of things.
I think that's a very important point you made, just about the words being limiting. Words, they are what creates our society. They are what allows for the mechanisms of society to take place, the society of which we're part. They are what allows us to relate to each other. But the whole spectrum that they're acting on, that they're expressing on, is a concept. It's not reality. It's not grounded in anything except words. And so we buy into it and we do so as to be able to engage with each other and take part and participate in society. But if you remove all of that, then you have this reality which doesn't have your name. It doesn't have the pronoun. It doesn't have. It's just, it's an experience of being which is life without any compartmentalization. Yeah.
So now people have kind of the list, the words they can start with that. And then if they want to go further into reflection, journaling and practices in the book, as you said, there's a couple of years worth of it. So they can really dive in into these practices. Anything else you want to add before we finish? If there's like one takeaway you'd like listeners to leave with today, what would that be for you?
You know, I might take advantage of this one takeaway. Just, you know, the book, it's broken down in a way where each week it's not very demanding. There's a reading.
It's quick, yeah.
Yeah, it's quite succinct. And the idea is that it's progressively leading you deeper and deeper into your understanding of the concepts. My idea for people after they'd read the book is that they would be in a position to write their own book. Not that they have to, but that they would feel like they've had such an insight into what the meaning of these concepts, and they've embodied it to the extent that they'd feel like I could put down my own version of what has been said in this book. And I think that's, you know, to kind of sum up a final thought, I think it's just, we're responsible for developing our relationship with ourselves physically, emotionally, and mentally, and to have the capacity to transcend those through discipline, through self-study, and through our own surrendering. So that would be facilitated through our reflection, through the yamas and niyamas.
I love that. I feel like people don't like to talk about taking responsibility for these things and are often more comfortable in the blame of what happens to you or, you know, the stories that we make up about our expectations and all the things. But when we are taking that responsibility and we are stepping into our own co-creation of what our life is, this is where there's true potential, I feel, for everything. I will put all your info in the show notes. But in the meantime, where's the best place for people to find you if they want to just say hello, they have more questions, they want to get your book, or they want to work with you in some way? Where do they go?
I have a website, which is www.davidmcgrath.ie for Ireland.ie. And then on Instagram, you know, you're on Instagram, so you'll be posting there and I'll be posting there. And if they want to send a message, it's probably an easy way. If they want to email, that's available on the website.
Thank you so much for your time today, David.
Thank you, Erica. Take care.
Thank you so much for joining us today. This is really now your last call for Recharge, Reconnect, and Reset the retreat coming up in 2 weeks. Check ericabelanger.com/retreat or DM me to chat about it and get details. You'll find the show notes for today's episode at ericabelanger.com/218. Before we go, I just want to say a last thank you to the team behind this podcast, all our premium members. Truly, without you, I wouldn't be continuing to do this podcast. So thank you so much for your support. Once again, thank you for listening. I'll see you next Monday.